Hello, this is Ken McLeod. Thousands of people around the world listen to these podcasts every week, just as you are doing now. If you find them helpful, please make a donation at unfetteredmind.org/donate. Your generosity helps us maintain and expand the website for the benefit of yourself and other practitioners worldwide. Thank you, and enjoy this podcast.
Unfettered Mind, A Trackless Path to Part 10.
Evening session, A Trackless Path 2. We're going to look at Ganges Mahamudra, or a few parts of it. Okay. August 9th. Twice in a row I got it right. Evening session, A Trackless Path 2. A couple of intentions here. One is possibly to teach you something about Mahamudra. It could happen. Second thing is something about translation and what to watch for in translation. It's a little pet peeve of mine these days. And the third thing is how to read texts like this. Because texts like this are different from most of the texts that we read in our education, and if we apply those ways, we often end up with some rather strange results. So I'll try to point these pieces out as we go along. Now, we already looked at the first verse. Mahamudra cannot be taught, Naropa, but with your devotion to your teacher and the hardships you've met, have made you patient in suffering and also wise. Take this to heart, my worthy student. So there are a couple of things that are worth noting. Now, first line, Mahamudra cannot be taught. Okay, what is one then to do? Now, there are probably a lot of different ways that you can understand that one line. And a couple of them we've already touched on. I can't teach you Mahamudra the way that I might be able to teach you how to add, or teach you how to bake bread, or teach you how to fix a flat tire. Because there isn't that thing there. It says, do this, now do this, now do this. That's one facet. The second facet is that this is about experience. And even though we have this term Mahamudra and we talk about learning how to experience the world a different way, you have your experience, I have my experience, and it's really very difficult, if not impossible, for us to compare our experiences. We can talk with each other and have the impression that we're talking about the same thing, but there's no guarantee. Have you ever had a conversation with someone and you thought you were talking about the same thing, and then you discovered sometimes later that you really were talking about two different things, and there was absolutely really no common ground? So that's the second point. And the third is somewhat related to the second, is that the way of experiencing that we call Mahamudra is something that's going to evolve in you. It's not going to be transplanted or anything like that. It's going to evolve in you. So there are things one can do to facilitate that evolution. Maybe there are things one can do to initiate the possibility of that evolution. But a lot of it depends on the conditions in your life and how you approach practice and cultural, psychological, emotional factors and so forth. And through this, something may evolve. Now, as you well know, in the interaction between teacher and student, student relates their experience or the teacher asks various questions, and something can happen in that interaction. Formally, this is called, say, pointing out instruction. In which the student experiences a shift in their way of experiencing. Most teachers who are capable of giving pointing out instructions, hopefully anyway, but I think it's the case, are sufficiently skilled to be able to detect by, I don't know what the actual physiological mechanisms are, but I prefer to use more informal language, a shift in energy, that some kind of shift has taken place. And then they may push or challenge the student to see how stable that shift is. In the primary Kagyu training text, which is the Ocean of Definitive Meaning, it's the title under which it's been translated, in the instructions to the teacher. At this point it says, try and trick the student. No, say something that's just wrong, push on them, etc., and see what they do. That's the actual instructions in there. So as I said the other evening, here, something's happened in Naropa. It was brought about by probably, I related to the incident, he's gone through all of these hardships, jumping off cliffs and getting beaten up by security guards, it just goes on and on. And finally, there's Talopa jumping up and down on his back as he tries to be a human bridge, and he just can't hold it. And then Talopa completely loses his temper. Now, if you were in Talopa's shoes, what would be happening in you? I mean, there you are. You've done absolutely your best. Your last ounce of strength is gone, and you slip up in the smallest way possible. And your teacher is slapping you across the face with a slipper. How is this for you? I mean, do we have to do this in fact? I'll oblige. Where's the microphone? So, how is this for you? Anybody? Jeff?
Like that. just, boom. Open.
Pardon?
Shock. Open. Startled.
No, come on, let's get realistic. shock, open? I don't think so. Maybe the shock part, but the open part, I'm not so sure. What's you going on? I mean, let's say you and I went for a walk. And we've done that a few. Okay, we've done that a few times. We go up in Red Rock Canyon, right?
There's no water.
That's fine. You know those steep steps carved in the ring? Yeah, I'm a little afraid of going downhill. I want you to carry me. And as you're carrying me down, you know how tricky those are. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm jumping up and down. Say faster, faster, faster. Okay.
Well, you know what I do.
I haven't finished yet. Okay. And you slip on one of the steps, and I go. And I say, how dare you? And I jump off, and I grab you, and I flip off my shoe, and I go, how dare you, Jeff? How dare you? Oh, what goes on in you?
I think it's a quick elbow strike.
Something like that, okay? Anybody else? If I really had a student.
I would think you were completely deranged.
Yeah. Okay, anybody else?
Devastated and furious.
Yeah, okay.
I might want a new teacher.
Okay. But this isn't what happened to Naropa. Why? Naropa had been trying so hard. He'd been trying so hard to be the good student. Really trying hard. And he had nothing left. He just couldn't be good enough for this teacher. And something just gave up on him. There it was. Let go completely of any hope. Any fear, because he didn't have anything left. Any identity as being a great scholar, a good student, a real student of the Dharma, etc. That was all gone. And he's just like, oh. And that's created the conditions in which he could just be. So, Tulopa recognized that and sang him the song. Now put yourself in Naropa's position here. Here's someone you've been following around northern India for probably a few years. I'm not quite sure how long. He's put you through hell any number of times. But you're longing and you feel this extraordinary connection with him that it doesn't matter what he does to you, you just know this is the right person for you. And you just had the last shred of any sense of being anybody at all blown out of you, or smacked out of you, and your mind is completely open and clear, and there is nothing at all there. And then this person says to you, consider space. What depends on what? Now, as you hear those lines, what happens in you? Anybody? Consider space. What depends on what? What happens? Ralph?
Well, I go blank. I can't figure it out.
Okay. You go blank. You don't know how to relate to it. Okay. Anybody? Okay.
I feel unsupported. I feel a kind of floating or falling.
Okay. Anybody else? Sophie?
I find myself trying to look at space without the objects, and without the objects, I don't see anything.
Okay. Anybody else? Gary?
I feel myself contracting.
Okay. Anybody else? Okay. So, what depends on what? So look at space, you know, and you can say, nice little chunk of space, right? Your favorite cubic foot of space. This one's mine, that one's yours. What depends on what? What do you experience? Gail?
My head opens up.
No, she's not on.
On standby.
Just leave it on. My head opens up.
Your head or your mind?
Whatever you want to call it.
Okay. All right. Go ahead. Mm-hmm. It just opens.
And I experience.
Yeah. So.
Space.
This is what Tulop is doing. What? Consider space. What depends on what? And when you look at this and. I mean, there's no answer to that. There's no answer at all. You can't even start with an answer. And so, stop. Everything stops. Likewise, Mahamudra, it doesn't depend on anything. Oh. This is the first pointing out instruction. Now comes the practice instruction. Don't control. Don't try to make it into anything. So, what depends on what? Let go and rest naturally. Let what binds you let go. And freedom is not in doubt. How do you let what binds you let go? How do you do that? Sonia.
You relate to what binds you.
Try again.
You confront what binds you.
It just bound you. Try again.
There's no one to bind.
As one teacher said to me, that was a very cooked answer. You practice yoga, right?
Yes.
How do you let the posture assume itself?
You completely release the form and then you're in it.
How do you let go? Let what binds you let go.
You completely release the form.
Do you feel the difference?
Absolutely.
You can't hold on to a thing. You can't even hold on to letting go. If you can do that, freedom is not in doubt. So that's the first pointing out. And then Talopa says, when you look into space, seeing stops. So, look at space right now. What happens? When you look at space, anybody?
You don't see anything.
Okay, say a bit more.
You're seeing is, it's a different experience from what we would normally call seeing, like looking across the room and seeing objects.
Yeah.
If you say, look at space,
there's a shift, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if we had our usual array of attorneys here, they would say, what do you mean? You still see things. You weren't here when we had two attorneys quizzing each other. That was hilarious. The one finally pinned the other one down, and to which the person said, well, that's personal. I'm not going to talk about that. So, when you get this instruction, look at space, there's a shift. Experience continues, but it's not the ordinary seeing. There's a very definite experience, but it's not conventional seeing. Seeing stops. Likewise, when mind looks at mind, the flow of thinking stops. So we can do the same thing. Look at mind. And there's a very similar shift. Now, Helen, could you pass the microphone, please? Oh, sorry, Nancy.
Is this related only to meditation? And I ask this because, I've been trying to look at my experience of being aware of awareness when I'm just looking at the environment and when I'm meditating. And they seem somewhat different.
How so?
For example, tonight I was looking out over the plain at the light coming through the clouds, and, you know, I mean, there were objects to see, but I was aware that I was aware of all of them. When I'm meditating, it's more like it's described here. Okay. And I'm curious about that.
What sees the clouds and the light?
Well, the awareness, the mind.
I know. It's your fault.
Thank you.
Pardon?
Glad I could help.
See, you didn't get blamed this time. Let's try that one again.
But actually, I don't really want to remember what you said. I come up with it myself.
What sees the clouds and the light? What you're experiencing right now?
It's that sort of empty, spacey feeling.
Yeah, okay. That's what Dolope is pointing to.
Okay, I guess then it's just not as strong as when...
You can practice it. Uh-huh. Yeah. Likewise, when mind looks at mind, the flow of thinking stops. And I want to make a very important point here. The flow of thinking stops. It doesn't necessarily mean that thoughts stop or experience stops. It's the flow of thinking stops. The thinking mind is a duller state of mind. The thoughts may pop up, but there's no thinking, which is different. Now, this verse makes it sound very easy. Look at mind, flow of thinking stops, bang, you're fully awake. Nothing to it. A lot of people get confused by this. There's this little matter of stability. And very, very much of our practice is about clearing the stuff away that destabilizes attention, and developing a sufficient level of attention so that when we look this way, the flow of thinking actually does stop. One needs a certain level of attention for that, and it needs to be stabilized. But they skip over that kind of thing frequently. So that's the second pointing out. Verse 4. Mists rise from the earth and vanish into space. They go nowhere, nor do they stay. I won't tell you how long I spent translating that particular line. If you look up some of the other translations, you'll see why. But I'm quite happy with how it turned out here. Mists rise from the earth and vanish into space. They go nowhere, nor do they stay. Where are the mists? I mean, when we look at this way, it becomes magical. Right? Pardon?
It's wonderful.
Yeah. Okay. It's a metaphor for thoughts. They arise like mists. Now, this favorite thought. Don't think of an elephant. What have you got in your mind right now? Okay? So, where is the elephant? Straightforward question. Anybody? Well, don't all speak at once. Come on. Where is the elephant? In the room, yes. Charles. Where's the microphone, please? Janet.
It isn't anywhere.
Do you experience it?
Yes.
What do you mean it isn't anywhere? How can you experience it?
I can't explain how it is.
You mean you can't explain such a straightforward thing as experiencing an elephant?
No, and so far as I can tell, nobody else can either.
Ah, but there's nobody here but you right now. So, you got that elephant clear in your mind?
Yes.
Where is it? Is it inside you or outside you?
Can't be either.
Okay. Let it go. He's very cooperative, this guy. Where did it go?
Didn't go anywhere.
It went, didn't it?
Yes, but it didn't go to somewhere.
What do you mean it didn't go anywhere? It went. So what are you experiencing right now? Just say it.
It stops. There's part of me is afraid.
Mm-hmm. But
it's very big.
Mm-hmm. Keep going.
Everything's there, but nothing's going on.
Okay. Good. So, this is what's going on here. Tilopa gives this analogy. And what's very important here is you take it as it arises in our experience. Look at these mists. They rise from the earth. they don't go anywhere, but they go. They're not there anymore. Now, we have all kinds of scientific explanations in terms of the dew point of the air and so forth, which, you know, heat of the sun, what have you. All of that's immaterial here. They arise, they're there, they don't go anywhere, but they're not there. And if you look at how thought arises in experience, it's exactly the same. There's nothing there. The thought's there. It can be in words, it can be in sound, or it can be image. Doesn't matter. It comes from nowhere, is there, but isn't anywhere that we can point to. And then it isn't there anymore, but it didn't go anywhere. Now, that's not normally how we relate to thoughts. But that is how one learns or develops the ability to relate to thoughts in Mahamudra practice. And all it involves, in a certain sense, is looking a different way and then stabilizing that looking. Likewise, though thoughts arise, whenever you see your mind, which is to say, whenever you look at space, etc., etc., the clouds of thinking clear. And even though thoughts may be there, the thinking process is disengaged, and there's a clearer experience, a clearer awareness. What's very important while I'm going through it this way is this is something that you do. It's not something you think about. It's not something that you study. It's not even something that you contemplate. This is something you do. You look this way. And you rest in the looking. Yes, Larry.
We've been talking about thoughts. You've been talking about thoughts from the text. The other day, am I correct in understanding that you said that in Tibetan this is just designated as movement of mind?
Yeah.
So basically, you could substitute the word thoughts for movement of mind, and it would comprehend even more.
Yes, because it would include things like feelings and images and
right.
It's all of that, yeah.
As well as appearances through the senses, the sense doors.
Yes, I mean, Tulopa's going for the what's subtle and relatively easy to see this way. Experiencing sensory perception the same way requires a quite a bit higher level of attention, but it's the same principle.
Right, and those two would be called movements of mind.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Pass to Carolyn, you. Please.
On those wonderful occasions when my mind is calm enough and quiet enough that I notice something literally moving, like boiling. And I look at it, so to speak, and it just vanishes. That's looking at mind as a thought. That's looking at the movement in mind, right? Then what is it when mind is that quiet, but I'm seeing, not seeing? Okay, so I can sit and look at the hillside. And if I'm incredibly lucky, there will come some part of a retreat's meditation when the hillside is there. I'm not calling it a hillside. I'm not calling it anything. But I'm seeing it. And those boilings still come. And I can still look at them, and they go away, but the hillside stays. What is that?
I'm not quite sure what you're asking.
Well, maybe I'm misunderstanding.
Experience arises in us in different ways. So the way sensory experience arises is through a very, very different mechanism or process from the way thoughts arise. And thoughts are more subtle and more fluid. So require, it's fairly easy to generate the level of attention so that one, so to speak, sees through them. There are a lot of people who, when they look at mind, their sensory perception dissolves into light. Yeah.
That's part one.
Okay.
But what I don't understand is how sensory perception can remain and this other thing can be dissolved by looking.
What needs to understand this?
Ken.
Thank you.
Okay, there's another thing that happens, and this, when I talk about it, I'm going to feel crazy.
Okay.
When I am working with someone in therapy, and I'm really quiet inside, very, very present, and it's one of those times when the thoughts dissolve when I look at them internally, obviously, but there will be a boiling in that same field, and if I look at it, it doesn't dissolve. It becomes a kind of a little play, but it's not mine. And over years now, I have sneakily asked questions like, what were you just thinking about? Mm-hmm. And it's their thought. Now I feel completely crazy saying that out loud.
Yeah, well then, there's quite a few crazy people in the world. Can I give you a technical explanation of what is going on? No.
Please.
No, I'm not. I can't. I mean, there are probably three or four modes that I could give you a string of words. But let me ask you a question. A much simpler question than the ones you're asking me.
Okay.
Why is the sky blue? Or let me ask this. According to the Tibetan tradition, why is the sky blue? It's because at the center of the world there is a giant mountain which has four faces. And one face is lapis lazuli, one face is emerald, one face is ruby, and one face is topaz. And the sky takes on the color of... The light from the sun reflects, and the sky and the ocean take on the color of that facet. So, north it's yellow, but in southern continent it's blue, because face is blue. Okay, that's according to the Indo-Tibetan tradition. According to Western science, why is the sky blue?
Something about refraction of light and
The light from the sun comes in, it just happens to be the frequency. It filters out everything except blue, so we see blue. Okay? Do either of these explanations explain why the sky is blue?
Not in any useful way.
No, exactly.
Okay, Ken, so am I crazy?
No, you're not crazy. This is your experience. Okay?
Yes.
That's it. All explanations are after the fact, and they involve some kind of assumption, some kind of theory, some kind of speculation. Purpose of explanations, and it's good that you raise this, the purpose of explanations is so that we can go back to sleep.
Okay, another walk into groundlessness.
I try to oblige.
Good job.
You know, you experience this, okay? It's not an unusual phenomenon, actually.
Good.
Because... someone close to you experiences a shock. They walk into the room. They don't say a word. What do you know?
You know.
You know.
Oh. I see exactly what you mean. Because I have an explanation for that one that works for me internally. I don't have to worry about it. I don't have to think about it.
It allows you to go back to sleep.
And this other one where I... Exactly. And the other one, because I don't
have a nice explanation for it.
Right.
So you can't go to sleep. Good.
Now I see exactly what you mean.
Yeah. And the other explanation isn't worth a piece of shit anyway.
Probably not, but no. It works for me.
No, it puts you to sleep.
Is it asleep when you use it?
It allows you to step out of the mystery of the experience.
Okay. It allows me to pretend that there's separation. That's what it does. Yeah. Yeah. It allows me to pretend I'm over here, they're over there, and I still...
You have this nice, neat explanation which keeps you over there and me here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Got it.
Thank you very
You're
much.
You're welcome. Pass the microphone to Ralph, please. No, I mean, you can talk to neuroscientists and...
This is the only
shamans and things like that. No, everyone will have an explanation for this.
Well, the neuroscientist...
No, don't worry. It's okay. I just wanted to throw that in.
I'm trying to make this simplified for myself. And let's take the example of a flower. If you have a flower in front of you...
If you have a flower in front of you and you think to yourself,
that flower's beautiful. That's one level. If there's a shift and you experience the flower, the experience of the flower may be joy or pleasure. The flower's still there, you're just not experiencing the same way, but it's still vanished. Because now you're experiencing it, you're not thinking about it. Is that correct?
Well, the concept of flower may have evaporated.
Yes.
There is an experience still taking place, and which, if I followed your example, and there's an emotional component in that experience, and one doesn't have to give a name to any of it in order to experience it. Okay. Okay. Yes, please, Helen.
It feels like it could be a problem in, well, we know this could happen to a few people in this world, that that then it's become something to hope for, or, you know, ambition to have this state of mind, so to speak.
Absolutely.
And
it's a big problem.
And then it's a problem, yeah.
Yeah.
Couple times I had a cranial sacral therapist work with my mouth area, and she had such presence that all of a sudden I became extraordinarily quiet. I'd never experienced that before by myself, and I still can't do it by myself. And even when I'm resting fairly well, I drift off into oblivion, or what you call it, referred to as dullness.
Mm-hmm.
But I just have real doubts about being able to do this. Does it matter? Does it really matter?
Well, you know the possibility's there. And you know what you do. That you become calm and then you become dull. So that's what you work at in your practice. Being stable attention without dullness. And the way that you do that is very short periods of meditation. Like, my favorite is the one breath meditation. And one can usually stay stable and clear for one breath. Relax. Then you do it again. After you've done that 10, 15, 20, 100 times, then you try a two-breath meditation. And you build capacity. Okay. Verse 5. Space is beyond color or shape. It doesn't take on color, black or white. It doesn't change. So, we haven't been doing too well in the sunset department this week so far. We usually have a few good ones here. And as Ogden Nash, and he said, anytime somebody says, come and see the sunset, you know that it's going to be outrageous. Garish. So, all of these colors, I mean, brilliant, subtle, beautiful. Is this space affected by that color at all? Yet without the space, could we perceive the color? And again, when you look at this way, it's like, huh, it allows us to experience the color in a different way. And now turn to your mind. Whatever's going on in your mind doesn't change mind. Whatever is going on in your mind doesn't change mind. Think of the most virtuous thought you can possibly imagine. And then think of the most evil thought you can possibly imagine. What about mind is different? Now, how many of you are concerned with being good? How many of you concerned with being good? How many of you are afraid of being evil? When you look at mind this way, what is the basis for this hope and fear? There's nothing there to change. What's it like to look at mind that way? Anybody? Nick?
It's tremendously liberating, to be honest with you.
Say it again.
It's tremendously liberating, to be honest with you.
It's tremendously liberating.
Yeah.
Say a bit more.
Just for me personally, I don't necessarily have the hope and fear of being good or evil in terms of my states of mind. But I'm definitely not. I'm not in a place where I want to do actions that are going to be harmful to myself and other people. So when I look at mine this way, and I was thinking about the same thing before you said that. All right, I have a really good thought float up, something, even maybe like a really good memory. And it has a texture and a feeling in my body. But whatever is aware of it, whatever experiences it, whatever facilitates it almost for it to arise, doesn't change.
Yeah.
Same thing with a ghastly awful time,
yeah,
or thought or something like that. It doesn't change. And then the experience, what happens, the way that I relate to that is, oh, I'm not either of those things. And now I can be at ease. And
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very good. Sophie?
It's almost as if that part of me that's always a judge is out of commission.
Yeah. How to decommission the judge. Okay. Anybody else? Can you connect with this? You're shaking your head. You can't connect. Okay.
I don't think that my concerns with good and evil have to do with how they affect my mind.
Mm.
I wouldn't have occurred to me that they would, but it's about suffering.
You can do the same with suffering and pleasure.
Right, but I guess that's a place where, oh, that's interesting, you know, to say that's a place where I won't let go.
It's not easy. I mean, one of the killer lines in the Great Path of Awakening, Kongtrul's commentary on 7 points of mind training, he's commenting on, after he's gone through Chikawa's 7 points, he pulls in a bunch of stuff, among them some lines from Serlingpa. And The one that I really had trouble with is suffering is the dance of what is. Suffering is the dance of what is. That's my translation. What he's saying is that suffering is the dance of the Dharmakaya. But it's exactly what we're referring to here.
And I believe that and can feel that from that absolute point of view, but from the relative point of view where I live my life, I'll still make choices based on the relative truth of suffering and the effect that my actions have on it. That doesn't contradict anything that you've said. I'm not going to act that way now. I'm not ready. Maybe yeah. When I really get it, I'll be ready to do that.
And if the circumstances call for it.
Right.
You know, which, you know, may or may never be encountered. Okay. So, Talopa here is pointing Naropa to the fact that there's this quality of experience that just doesn't change. And Taranatha would, it's a short text by Taranatha that I had in the retreat. Taranatha was just very glib about these things. Well, it doesn't change because there's nothing to change. But all of these are pointing to the mystery of experience. And how to experience the mystery of experience completely is what all of this is about. It's not about trying to understand it. It's about being completely in the experience of this very, very strange thing we call life, in which when we really open to it, doesn't make any rational sense. It's just arising out of nowhere, goes nowhere, isn't anywhere, and yet it's very, very vivid experience. And whenever we step away from it, that's when we get into trouble. Verse 6. The darkness of 1,000 eons cannot dim the brilliant radiance that is the essence of the sun. Likewise, eons of samsara cannot dim the sheer clarity that is the essence of your mind. Now, Rinpoche, when he taught about mind, he almost always would teach it in terms of emptiness, clarity, and unrestricted experience. You're benefiting from many years. When I was translating from, I didn't have that really good word, unrestricted. It's had much messier translations. Look at your mind. When you look at your mind, you don't see anything. But if you're asked, there's nothing there, that how you experience it, you're unlikely to say, yeah, there's this. It's not like the nothing there of empty space. There's a quality. A quality is called clarity. Other translators have other terms for it, but clarity I think is fine. And you can say it is the potential for knowing. Now, if you're asked, what is the difference between the being nothing there and the clarity? You'd be very hard to answer. the emptiness or the being nothing there is the clarity, and the clarity is the being nothing there. Now, when you experience that, it doesn't matter what arises in your mind, that quality of experience is always there. We don't always know it because of habituation and conditioning and all of that stuff. But it is actually always there. And this is what this verse is referring to. We've done this already in this evening in another way. Whatever is going on in your mind, even if it's completely crazy, as it sometimes is, if you're asked, what is aware of the craziness? What is aware of the depression? What is aware of the dullness? What is aware of the anxiety? Any of those questions. The moment that question is asked, you experience the clarity. It may only be for a fleeting second, but the moment that question is asked, you experience it. And this is what Tilopa's saying. Eons of samsara, which is a poetic way of saying, however confused you are, but that clarity, that there's still a knowing going on. In the Dzogchen tradition, there's a practice where you imagine that you're in various of the six realms, and you really get into it, you know, being in the hell realm, being in the hungry ghost realm. And then you imagine that you're an enlightened being. You imagine yourself in all of these different things. And the purpose of this exercise is it doesn't matter how bad, how horrible it is, or how enlightened, how brilliant, or how ephemeral it is, or how solid it is, how black it is, how light it is, whatever. But there's always that knowing. It's always there. That's why we say in the refuge, knowing that experience and awareness are not two. Take refuge in the Dharma. It's always there. And much of our practice consists of recognizing it and then stabilizing that recognition. Yes. Microphone, please.
You make a distinction between clarity and looking.
Clarity and?
Between clarity and looking.
Yeah.
And so, based on what you just said about the clarity always being there, is it fair to say there is an experience or an act of looking, and the quality of that experience is clarity?
The looking brings out the clarity aspect. Yeah. And that's one of the reasons why, in pointing out instructions, once given, told to look this way, it's to bring it out. Hopefully so that you recognize it. That's how it's pointed out. That's helpful?
Yes.
Okay. Jeff?
You could do that with listening as well, could you?
Yes. Okay. But elaborate for everybody else, please.
Well, I don't recall if I tried that before or after reading Stephen Batchelor's book when he was in...
Which one?
Talking about his experience doing Zen. I think it was...
Faith,
I don't know.
Faith Stout?
No, it was it was a guy in L.A. who was a client. He was talking about listen, just listen. And if you do that, it's very similar.
Yeah.
It can take you right there.
Okay. Yeah. Verse 7. Although you say space is empty, you can't say that space is like this. I mean, okay. Oh, I think I've said it very well there. You know, it's so we come up with all of these words, as I've mentioned before. But it's impossible to describe in words. And
yet you make us try.
And yet that's not quite true. I don't make you try. What I do is I push you as best I can into the experience so that you will let go and let the experience speak. It's quite a difference. Because as long as you are trying to speak, you're getting in the way, and I just keep bashing you around until you give up and let the experience speak. Something like that. Figuratively. So, this is very much to the point. If I try to describe the experience, then inevitably it becomes something else. And it's objectified. If instead, saying it one way, I speak directly from the experience, or saying it another way, the experience speaks or expresses, then it's absolutely direct. And if you take and in the pointing out instructions, that's what the teacher is actually looking for. It's the same in koan practice in Zen, that you're given these things, and what the teacher in Zen is looking for is the experience speaking. It doesn't matter what the experience says, as long as the experience speaks. And it's very difficult, because we want to control everything. I remember doing some work, a small group that I was part of, and there's a psychiatrist in the group who had some ability. And my friend and I kept pushing him and pushing him to let the experience speak, and finally just sat there like this. Oh, that was good. Because there was no him there anymore. It was just directly from the experience. Verse 8. Thus the nature of mind is inherently like space. It includes everything you experience. That's what the Tibetan says. It includes everything you experience. I would just say it is everything you experience. Mind is what you experience. What you experience is mind. Now, it's wonderful. You can dress this up in really formal philosophical vocabulary, and it sounds so much more sophisticated and significant. How does it go? Your mind, yes. Mind itself is the phenomenal world, whatever, or the world of phenomenal experience or something like that. You know, but it just means the same thing. Mind is your experience. Your experience is mind. Now, what happens when you hear that? What happens in you? Mind is your experience. Your experience is your mind. What happens in you when you hear that? Sophie?
It makes me feel connected.
Okay. Anybody else? I do not approve of silence.
I kind of went, whoa, inside. And it just went, whoop, opened up.
Okay. Anybody else?
I think I'm the opposite. I was kind of like at rest.
Okay, but there's a shift, isn't there?
Right.
Yeah. And you experience that shift in different ways. But you can feel a letting go, like maybe things opening up. Okay. That's how it is. And it's that way of experiencing things that we're seeking to cultivate in this practice. Because it has all of those qualities of extraordinary space and openness and rest, no separation. Okay? Larry.
I think that my conditioning that I have to work to put aside is this notion that the mind is up here. And so I have to tap myself on the shoulder and bring it down to the heart or in here somewhere. I know you'll remind me that it's the whole package. And I don't...
Forcefully.
Nevertheless, it's difficult. It's a challenge because of that conditioning.
Yeah. You're not alone, of course. There's the whole Cartesian sense, the homunculus, is the little thing inside, which is actually our mind. But it was very present in Asian ways of thinking too. And you can look at much of Buddhist practice as a way of prying ourselves away from that way of looking at consciousness in here and experience and things out there, rather than this world of experience. Mahamudra, Dzogchen, bare attention, Shikantaza, all of these. They're doing. Eric, microphone.
You said something to the effect of this isn't to be studied or even contemplated. Is this this practice that we're basically doing here tonight worthwhile to do, even if one is not at the level of practicing Mahamudra?
Why not?
Just asking.
I did a retreat with the teacher, Keelung Rinpoche, in many years ago in Colorado. And it was... quite unexpectedly, it was quite a significant retreat for me. And it was a 3-week retreat, and towards the end of the retreat, I was we had an interview with Keelung Rinpoche about every 3 or 4 days. And so I was meeting with him one afternoon, and he was quite tired from the whole retreat. And I was muttering something about my experience, and he was saying, yeah, yeah, okay, fine, yeah, 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 yeah. And then I said, and it's very clear to me that none of this is possible without clearing, a phrase in Tibetan tradition, clearing away the obscurations and gathering the accumulations. So it's not Drip Zhang. And it was very interesting. He immediately went, oh, I'm so glad to hear you say that, Ken. And he just woke up completely and expressed his quite heartfelt frustration that people felt that because they'd had some kind of pointing out, some kind of glimpse of possibilities, that that constituted Mahamudra or Dzogchen practice. It's the seed. And as I've said a few times in this retreat, much of the work is building the capacity so that this can be present and stabilized. And that's traditionally speaking why you do things like prostrations and Vajrasattva, mantle offering, and all of those. They aren't the only ways. That's the way that capacity was built in largely in the Tibetan tradition. Yidam practice, Guru Yoga, all of these things play a role. There are other ways of the capacity can be developed, and I think one of the things that's happening in Buddhism in America right now is figuring out ways that are more appropriate for our culture, for those kinds of the same kinds of processes to take place. Now, whatever level of practice, whatever amount of practice, it's actually quite good to keep dropping into this whenever you can. The problem arises only if you think, all I need to do is drop into it. I don't need to do any of the other stuff. Which is where a lot of people go to because they don't want to work that hard. They feel they're above it or you know, better than that, and so forth. That's a problem. That if you, and this is why I was talking the last few days about this longing, because when you feel this longing, you and you sense the possibility, then you get a very clear idea of what it's going to take to move out of those very deeply habituated ways of relating to experience. And that's why I was talking right at the beginning of the retreat about 10,000 hours and all of that stuff. it requires that kind of investment, because there's a lot of conditioning to change. Okay?
Thank you.
Okay. Charles.
I'd like to ask more about what's traditionally translated the two accumulations or the two ways of growing. So I think I have a pretty clear idea of the first one. So now, merit, right? Things that develop positive momentum in your life. I do not have a good idea of the second way of growing. Exactly. Can you... is that just what you usually call developing higher capacity and attention? Please tell me, how do you work on that?
I have on good authority that there's nothing to it.
So why not just have one accumulation?
The way that I... I've moved away from the translation of accumulation, because it's a spiritual bank account in the sky. You put in it, it even collects interest, and you cash it in. You know what the Chinese word for sunam is? Luck. Yeah, I mean, because you, how do you get luck? How do you make good things happen in your life? Well, according to the Tibetan tradition, you accumulate merit. How do you do that? You make lots of offerings. And the Chinese are very clear about this. They make lots and lots of offerings to the lamas because it brings them luck. And it's total spiritual materialism. Now, so that's why I've moved away from translating it as accumulation. For the first one, I like to think of it as generating goodness. It's quite a shame what's happened to English language in the course of the 20th century. Goodness is kind of a unfashionable term. And yet, there's power in goodness. And it's very unfashionable to think in these terms. The word virtue is derived from the Latin word, which means strength. So virtue means strength. It's not how we think of it today. I think of it more in terms of goody-two-shoes. And it's really very sad that the language has been debased this way, because it prevents us from relating to these things in a powerful, strong way. And some of the translation points I want to bring up. So I use the translation generating goodness. Now, how do you generate goodness? By doing good, and it accumulates momentum, and it changes how you experience things. Mark Twain: the best way to cheer yourself up is to cheer somebody else up. That's very true. Pardon? Specifics? Well, yeah, I'll give you an example. When I was in L.A., soon after I moved to L.A. in the mid-80s, there was a person, a woman that I'd known when she was very young, when she was in her late teens in Vancouver, when I was there with Rinpoche, and was not expecting to run into her at all in L.A., but she'd moved to L.A. years before, and I moved in some very interesting circles. But she was extremely, she was very glad that I was there, and she was very helpful to me. And one day, she called up and said she was depressed. I said, so, come over and pick me up. I didn't have a car at that point. So she came over and picked me up. I said, let's go down to Fisherman's Wharf. And went down there. I said, so give me $20. Why? There we go. Need to reset there, right?
No, it's still going.
Okay. You're going to freeze some fish, bait fish. And so she gave me $20 and we got this. And so she said, I'm going to pay me hung, I'm tired to tarry too, so I'm got to get the, you know, mantras and so forth. And it took about 10 minutes dumping these fish and into the ocean at the marina. And then we left. And as we left, she looked at me and said, that worked. That worked. Yeah, she wasn't feeling depressed anymore. Because doing good. And it's a completely meaningless activity. And it doesn't have to be a meaningless activity. You can help people who are sick, you know, do whatever. But there is a lightness of mind that comes through doing good. And that's what the generating of goodness or accumulation of merit really refers to. It's a lightening and clearing of mind from doing good. And one doesn't have to go into the whole karmic bank account, compound interest and penalties for early withdrawal, all of that. Now, the second accumulation, the second generation, was probably added on because just doing good isn't enough. It doesn't free you from samsara. It gets you higher births and all that stuff in the traditional descriptions. I mean, but without that insight, that seeing into how experience arises, one doesn't actually get free of the conditioning. So it was necessary to add in this other one, the generation or accumulation of pristine awareness, which is a really tricky thing because, as I said rather glibly a few moments ago, there's nothing to it. So how you actually do that is exactly what I was suggesting to Eric. You drop into it. And through this process, you gradually familiarize your whole being with experiencing things that way. And again, that generates a momentum. Okay? But it's not a thing you do. I mean, you don't get anything. It's just something you do. Okay? That answer your question?
I think so. So the four Tibetan words that you mentioned earlier, right, that you said you needed to do to Rinpoche, if we put it in the kind of language that you use now, right, the same idea, would be you nurture, you develop goodness,
mm-hmm.
you work on and clear away your emotional reactivity.
Yep.
That would be the drip. Yeah, right. One of the dripjong. There's the other one. Okay, Ken. How would you now explain the other one of the dripjong?
Well, there's... and I'll give you the Tibetan because you know it. Nyumongpi Dripa and Sheja Dripa.
Right, okay. So I'm asking about Sheja Dripa.
Well, Sheja Dripa corresponds to accumulating pristine or generating pristine awareness. Because Sheja Dripa means the obscuration or the shadowing or clouding of experience through from conceptual knowing. And pristine awareness is non-conceptual knowing. So that's the correspondence. And so again, that dropping, even if it's for a moment, into non-conceptual knowing helps to clear away the clouding of experience with conceptual knowing. It's what I was saying earlier. The thinking mind is a dollar state of mind.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Okay. I wanted to touch on a couple of more points. Verse 9. This is instruction. Stop all physical activity. Sit naturally at ease. Do not talk or speak. Let sound be empty like an echo. Do not think about anything. Look at experience beyond thought. So, the first 2.5 lines, very clearly, you're saying, do nothing. And then he gives you something to hold on to. Mahamudra are not being quite as drastic as Dzogchen. You get this little thing. He's encouraging Naropa to bring out the looking quality, which brings out the clarity aspect of experience. Look at experience beyond thought. Now, don't think about it, just do it. What happens? You think about it, you just tie yourself up in knots. Just look at experience beyond thought. What happens when you do that? Anybody? Rita? Right here.
It was like a dropping in and a shift.
Okay, yeah. Anybody else? Nick?
Yeah, dropping in is a good phrase, actually, because it feels like you're coming down out of something.
Okay.
That's dreamlike and confusing. Aren't
okay. So, look at it. Christy, did you have something?
No.
I thought you put your hand up. Or are you just wiping your forehead?
Yeah.
Okay, fine. I just didn't want you to feel left out. So, there's a shift. Dropping in, however you want to put it. That's the practice. That's it. Sit and shift. Christy! Pardon?
I screwed up my courage. When I think I experience that, it's like things become three-dimensional.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Very vivid. It's like...
Right.
Yeah.
That's all. Thanks.
Good. Rest there. And initially, it won't last very long. You know? Maybe a second or two. But you keep doing it. As you practice this, verse 10 describes experience. One second, Paul. This is, now, it's not describing fact, it's describing experience. And this is not instruction, it's describing experience now. And this is one of the tricky things in reading these kinds of texts, is it's very important to discern what's instruction, what's description of experience, etc. Because I know many texts that have been translated in which the translator has translated descriptions of experience as instructions. That kind of makes a mess of things. Or sometimes, and this is actually even more problematic, that they've translated instructions as descriptions of experience. And so people think, well, this is just meant to happen. And they don't realize this is something you're meant to do. And sometimes the Tibetan verb forms are confusing because, the imperative and the future are often the same. So, your body has no core. You work this way and you experience. It's just like your body feels hollow, like bamboo, just like he says. Your mind goes beyond thought, open like space. So, he's saying that when you do it this way, that experience is going to arise. When that experience arises, let go of control and rest right there. Mind without projection is Mahamudra. Train and develop this and you will come to the deepest awakening. It's very, very clear instruction. Okay. Paul, you had a question.
I think I did something wrong because while you were talking to him, I sat and asked myself, what experience is this? And I felt like that I was feeling the flow of experience, but then suddenly there was panic and nausea, and I opened my eyes and the room was spinning. And it wasn't pleasant.
Yeah. That happens. It can happen for any number of reasons. Sometimes there's just other parts of us just react against this and shut the whole thing down. And make it completely inaccessible to us. And that's just the mechanisms that I was talking about the other day. There's a story that is often referred to, Milarepa and the demons. And usually just the last part of the story is told. And it's unfortunate because when the last part of the story is told, you get a very mistaken impression of what's really going on. But the whole story consists of Milarepa has been practicing really, really hard. And he's been practicing so hard, he's been neglecting his body. He hasn't been taking care of himself at all. And so he's barely got enough strength to do anything. He's just been pouring all of his energy into practice. So he realized, oh, I can't do anymore. I actually have to take care of the body. And he's barely got enough strength to walk. So he starts walking around his cave and manages, after going some distance, to find sufficient kindling to light a fire so he can cook something for himself. But he's really, really weak. And so as he's coming back with this load of, probably not a very large load of wood, he trips and stumbles and all the wood goes all over the place. And he's had it. He's dead. He doesn't have any more strength. Everything lets go. And he has this vision of Marpa. His guru. And Marpa says something appropriately, encouraging and so forth. But he just, this incredible vision, it just fills him with energy. And he goes back to his cave with the sticks. And he finds these demons there. Now this is very important. frequently what happens when there's some kind of opening is that habituated patterns which operate so that a lot of things just are not experienced and not felt are really seriously triggered by that spiritual opening. Because now we experience everything, and we can experience everything. And so they just jump into operation, just like switch goes on. And everything just closes down really, really hard. Nausea, sickness, dullness of mind, pain in the body, you name it. It can all happen.
Wanting to run out of the room.
Exactly, yeah. That's it. Yeah. That's right. So it's not necessarily that you did anything wrong. This is the stuff that we have to deal with. And that's where my comments this morning about war come in. Because that's exactly what Milarepa tries to do. He tries to get rid of the demons. He declares war on them, and it goes nowhere. And that's the part of the story that's usually related. It's until he actually accepts this as part of his experience that he can move forward. But this first part is very important because it describes how those demons get there. They're the reactive patterns reacting to the spiritual opening.
So what should I do?
What we do all along here is just open to what you're experiencing and be in it to the best of your ability. And it's like, and that's how it is sometimes.
It was pretty powerful, though. I felt like I was going to pass out.
Yeah. And sometimes you will. And you know what happens then?
What?
You know what happens then?
What?
You come to. Life goes on.
Okay.
Seriously. That's what happens.
I see the potential for an aversion to that practice.
We all have our obstacles. Okay, well, I was planning to do a little bit more in Mahamudra, but it's 10 to 9 now, so maybe we can pick that up tomorrow. Let's just take a few minutes, stretch, and then we'll sit down, sit together for a short time.
Unfettered Mind retains all rights to these podcasts. If you do wish to use a part or a whole podcast, please send an email to podcasts@unfetteredmind.org.